Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on Memorial Day here on the Ideas Network. Very happy to have you with us today as we continue a tradition that started some years ago with the passing of the late Sam Robbins. We talk about resident and migrant birds of Wisconsin with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County. He's the historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Bill Volkert is with us. He's a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horican Marsh. And first off, Noel, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, it's always great to be with you, Jim, and all the listeners around the state and outside of Wisconsin.
You just got back from a little birding trip to another part of Wisconsin than Ozaukee County, and you asked the question to your birding friends, where in Wisconsin was I standing in a single spot this morning to hear the following species within a 30-second period? And you list about 30 birds that you heard in that 30-second period. And only one person was able to guess the answer, and you say that they probably had inside information.
That's right. I've been doing some bird surveys in different locations around the state, in addition to just going out and birding on my own with my son. And last night we took a trip up to listen for yellow rails in Comstock Bog outside of Princeton. But this one particular spot, I was just struck by the diversity of species. It was species I was in a kind of a mixed habitat where I could hear grassland birds, but also migrants that are just going through the area, plus some woodlands and along with some water. So it was really a fantastic spot, and I just kind of stood there and soaked in all the bird songs for a while, and I thought I'd throw it out to the folks that monitor the listserv that we have here in Wisconsin. And it was kind of interesting to hearing the responses, everything, as you said, from various corners of the state to my backyard. And John Fife, who I believe you had on the program,
yes,
talking about bird song, he thought I was just inside listening to his tape.
So, and you actually were in La Crosse.
I was in La Crosse. Yeah, I'm doing a survey out there looking at doing some sand prairie restoration at the La Crosse Airport. And it's a really interesting site because it's a sand grassland that they mow, but there's enough prairie plants and trees and so forth that I'm surprised how rich the bird life has been.
Well, we're glad to have you along, and of course, this is a very important time for the Horican Marsh International Education Center, and Bill Volkert, I know, has got a smile on his face when he's able to talk about this new facility.
Well, we're all set to go. The building project was approved by the Wisconsin Building Commission. Our friends group has been working on fundraising campaign for more than 10 years on this, so it's been a long time in coming. And looks like groundbreaking in August for a $4.8 million facility at Horican Marsh, which will serve as a destination for this large marsh. And, you know, Horican is certainly well known, but it's not always easy to get into or get around because it's such a vast property. And it's, I think for people who are not familiar with it, the few access points that are available are sometimes, I suppose, a little elusive. So this will give people a place to go to get that orientation and understanding of the real importance of the marsh and direct them to get out to really experience it.
Horican Marsh is a state wildlife area, a national wildlife refuge, and a unit of the Ice Age National Scientific Area, also recognized as a globally important bird area. It received the prestigious title of a wetland of international importance in 1991. About how big an area are we talking about?
Horican Marsh is 13.5 miles long, up to 5 miles wide, 32,000 acres or 51 square miles. Any way you want to cut that, it's very vast, and it's also extremely rich for the conservation of our bird life, both for the migrants that stop there en route to places even further north, and as right now, a endpoint for the summer nesting birds. And a lot of birds will be seen out there. We just held the Horican Marsh Bird Festival 2 weeks ago on the International Migratory Bird Day, and 157 species were sighted in and around Horican Marsh just on that single weekend. So not only a lot of bird life there that depends on the marsh, but a lot of recreational opportunities for people to get out and see and experience birds at the right time of the year.
We'll talk about Horican Marsh, and we'll talk about birds when we get your calls. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. We do have lines open for your calls. Let's take a call to get started, and that would be Tom in Meriton. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I have a question, and something this is perhaps which you have dealt with on previous programs, and that is, in general, is the bird population decreasing across the board, the songbirds, the migrating birds, and so on? I just wonder about that with all the concerns about global warming and destruction of habitat and everything all over the world. Is the number of birds decreasing? Can you even say that?
Well, Noel, since you're the editor, the senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, you've got a handle on this, I'm sure.
Well, there's no question that there's a significant number of bird species that breed in Wisconsin that are decreasing, but there's also a similar number that are increasing, and there's a similar number that are pretty much stable. A couple years ago, I kind of coined this as Noel's rule of thirds. About a third of our species are declining, about a third are increasing, and a third are pretty well stable from all indications over the last few decades. One of the problems we have is that many of the species that are increasing are those that are somewhat generalist. They can use a variety of habitats. They can coexist around man quite well. In fact, some of them are even enhanced by what man does to the landscape. The ones that are decreasing tend to be a little bit more of a habitat specialist, meaning their life requirements are narrower. They need specific habitats to exist in, or they have specific food habits, or really narrower in their ability to breed and survive and carry on to the next generation. And of course, those are the ones we're quite concerned with. But, you know, we have a number of species that are increasing over the last few decades. I think we all recognize that what's happened to the breeding Canada geese in Wisconsin and the number of gulls that we have, and certainly wild turkeys. And like I said, there's a wide variety of species, some of them even wetland species, woodland species that are increasing. I guess the group of birds in general that have declined the most over the recent decades are the grassland birds and also those that like shrub habitats.
And, Bill, let's give you a chance to weigh in on this.
Well, actually, it's a question I commonly throw out to the students and visitors of the marsh is exactly that. How is wildlife doing? And it's in a sense, a trick question, because if you answer increasing or decreasing, you're right. And it is exactly that trade-off that we are seeing the increase of those generalists. But yet the ones that are decreasing, these are the ones of real concern because there's an increasing list of them. And wildlife is essentially a byproduct of the landscape, and whether that's here or in their tropical wintering grounds or wherever in between, as land changes, wildlife is going to respond differently. Some will see new advantages. Some are going to be losing out as the same result of those changes. And so we're really looking at a landscape scale and continental scale, taking a look at how our economies and politics and lifestyle changes impacting the landscape, and what can we do for conservation to hang on to enough areas for those that really are sort of boxed in ecologically. They can't shift. They can't move. Without that habitat, they lose out. How can we hang on to enough of them to keep them around? And that's where the Important Bird Areas program comes in. We're looking globally at what are the most critical sites we have to protect if we're going to protect the 10,000 species of birds that are on this planet. And some are obviously a more critical risk than others. And so we want to do more than just a triage-type conservation. We also want to get ahead of it to keep things from becoming threatened or endangered and to try to help those that we know right now are already in trouble.
Tom?
As I expected, a complicated answer. Thank you very much.
All right, we appreciate that. And you'll have a chance to turn your inquiry into action because we've got some bird surveys coming up that we'll be talking about. Our guests are Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, and our telephone number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Call in with your questions, your sightings, and we'll try to get an answer for you. Let's go next to Paul in New Berlin. Hello, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Couple of questions. One about hawks and falcons. Live in New Berlin and ride the bike trail that parallels the high voltage transmission line about a half a mile south of Greenfield Avenue quite regularly, and routinely see a whole bunch of different kinds of hawks and I'm not sure falcons. I'm not very good at identifying the different ones, especially when they're up in the air flying around and I don't have field glasses. I was just kind of wondering how many different species are typically found in this area.
Noel, is that something that you...
Sure, I'll give it a shot.
You're closer anyway.
Yeah, New Orleans not too far south from where I live. Well, by far the most common species that you're going to see when you're out around the countryside, especially in southeastern Wisconsin, is the red-tailed hawk. This is the common Buteo-type hawk that enjoys a variety of habitats, but mostly in open and also in woodland areas. And you'll see them perched on the transmission towers, electric transmission towers and poles that you mentioned. They'll nest in large stick nests in woodlots and woodlands in the area, or even in trees and in fence rows. So that's going to be the most common species that one will usually see. But we also have Cooper's hawks, which is a species that's rebounded in populations and continues to expand its number. It's a species that pursues birds, so it has a broad, rounded wings where they can adapt quickly in flight, long tail, kind of acts as a rudder. But then you'll have, as you mentioned, falcons. The most common falcon we have is the small American kestrel or sparrowhawk, as you'll see in the older field guides. So those would probably be the three most common species of raptors that you'll find in southeastern Wisconsin during the breeding season. But you also may see turkey vultures, which look like raptors, even though they're really not that closely related to raptors. They're increasing in number, breeding throughout the state now, especially in the southern part of Wisconsin. You may see northern harriers. You may see, now that we have ospreys back in the southeastern part of Wisconsin, and even bald eagles now nesting in this part of the state, you may still see those in the summertime. So there's five or six common, but there may be possibly as many as 10 species. More uncommon species like broad-winged hawks and red-shouldered hawks are also possible.
Well, thank you. Also had a question about catbirds. We have some catbirds nesting in our yard, and they seem to have a rather random song. It doesn't seem to repeat very much, if at all. And I was wondering if anybody's studied this and found out that it's a form of communications, much like chickadees use, or is this, chickadees seem to be much less random, but I was just wondering if there was any form of communication with this, or is that an unknown quantity?
Bill?
Well, for catbird, what you're hearing, that rambling, is the true song. The meow of the catbird, the little chatter that they do, those are the call notes. In other words, communication between individuals as contact notes, warning for danger. The song is actually for breeding then, to establish a territory, keeping other males out, saying this is my place, and to lure a mate. And birds have got a lot of different ways of trying to communicate it. For example, woodpeckers don't even have a good voice box for the most part, and that's the drumming, the rattling on a tree serves as their song, so to speak. The catbird is a mimic. It's in the family, which is appropriately called Mimidae. Probably the best known among that whole group is the mockingbird. And rather than having their own distinct song, they elaborate it by incorporating other bird songs and just this on-chattering, rambling, and so forth. And so we pick out the catbird not by a specific voice, though that sort of meow that they throw in is usually a giveaway, but that endless rambling and chattering. And again, it just serves the same purpose. And perhaps for that bird, the mimicking, the ability to become more and more vocally elaborate, the repertoire that they develop, maybe that's what really finally wins them the mate.
Paul, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate your questions. I had something that occurred to me. Yesterday we were doing What Do You Know, a program with an expert on insects down in Illinois, and of course we've got the emergence of the cicadas, the 17-year cicada in southern Wisconsin. Do birds like cicadas when these cicadas emerge by the hundreds of thousands? What happens to the bird population then? Do you have any idea on that, Noel?
I don't know if the populations will really respond much to cicadas. They certainly will to other types of insects. Certain caterpillar worm outbreaks in spruces, for example, you'll see warblers responding to that, and you'll see increased numbers and increased production. Cicadas are so large, they're going to have fewer bird species that can really tackle them.
Mm-hmm.
But you will see birds taking them. And I remember growing up in southern Ohio in the first year we really had a large cicada outbreak. You'd watch birds hopping around. It just almost they didn't know where to look next. There were so many cicadas around. But they will definitely take them.
Any thoughts on that, Bill?
I think it's just a matter of opportunity. If all of a sudden there's a big hatch for those that can handle something as large and robust as cicada, why not? Otherwise, they'll shift over to other kinds of foods. It's just a very small select group of birds that can take something that big. It's just a glut, which happens periodically.
We're talking about ornithology with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president and current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. He's a senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And Bill Volkert, a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR Bureau of Wildlife Management. He's stationed at the Horican Marsh. And we'll be back to take your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jim Packard, and we're talking about resident and migrant birds of Wisconsin with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. And we'll take your calls at 263-1890 in Madison or toll-free at 800-642-1234. Back to the phones and to Al and Wesby. And Al, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Jim. I wondered if the guests could discuss the differences between blackbirds, grackles, and starlings, and then address an issue if they're predators as far as robbing other birds' nests, as far as eggs or young, like robins or orioles, other birds like that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Noel, do you want to start with that?
Sure. Blackbirds is a general term for several different species. He mentioned grackles. The common grackle is one of the blackbird in the blackbird group, along with brown-headed cowbird and red-winged blackbird. Those would be probably the three most common birds in the blackbird group. But there are other less common species also in that. So it's the blackbird family's Icteridae. It also includes things like bobolink and the meadowlarks are in the blackbird family also. So this is the common general term blackbird, typically, as I said, mentions or usually includes red-winged blackbird, common grackle, and brown-headed cowbird. Starling is in its own separate group and not related all that closely to blackbirds. The European starling is the species that we have here in Wisconsin. It's an introduced species, and I say it's not really related closely to blackbirds at all. Sometimes crows are even thrown into the blackbird group, even again, just like the starling. It's not related at all to the blackbird group. Asking about whether they're predators, typically not. Common grackles may, on occasion, destroy the nest of another species, but for the most part, the blackbird family is not a predator of other species. One of the problems with European starling, and one of the reasons we don't like to have this introduced species around, it nests in cavities, and it competes quite strongly with other cavity nesters such as our woodpecker species and also our eastern bluebird. And so it's a very strong competitor for nest cavities with some of our native species.
Bill, let me ask you about the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, which is involved in helping to protect birds.
Well, the Wisconsin Conservation Initiative was organized probably 3-4 years ago as a concept and become a series of working groups and projects that we've zeroed in on. This is really the Wisconsin portion of the national North American Bird Conservation Initiative. And the real idea here is that we cannot manage every single species of bird individually. We certainly do if they're a game species or an endangered species. We give them special attention. But we're also looking preventatively to keep birds from becoming threatened or endangered, and to keep the common birds common, and to try to look at what we're referring to as a series of guilds, those birds that are not, say, scientifically related to each other, but are ecologically related in that they need the same kind of habitats and share these areas. And how can we strategically look at the important bird areas, which is one component of it, what are the most important bird areas, and how can we develop regional strategies for conserving those birds across the state? And we're really using our ecological landscapes map that we did to look at the major 30-some communities in Wisconsin and a regional and strategic conservation approach. Another component is the Wisconsin Bird and Nature Trail. This was very successfully organized down in Texas, and we've taken that idea. It's nearly complete. There are a series of brochures out there with maps that take you to some of the important bird areas and good bird watching spots. There are a number right around Milwaukee County, around some of the other urban areas in the state, and of course some of the great spots in the Northwoods, the Mississippi River, along the Great Lakes, and so forth. So that is a way to, one important bird area, protecting and identifying the most important, a strategic approach statewide to look at what are the most important conservation issues in different regions and how can we manage groups of birds by these guilds. And we're also developing a bit of an international component. I've been helping on that committee. And here, since we recognize that birds do migrate out of our country where we don't have then uniform protection within the United States, they go to Mexico, Central America, and South America, how can we start to identify some common links? And bird watchers certainly recognize these are birds we refer to as ambassador species because they do link us with common conservation interests with people in the tropics. And how can we actually identify some common concerns and causes and even support people down there? There's a recent project that we were working on in Cornell University, New York, actually jumped the gun on that one. They had the same idea. The golden-winged warbler was a critical species, and they're taking money from the U.S. to send it to Colombia to their conservation organization for them to do more concerted winter surveys of the habitat conditions and the distribution of the golden-winged warbler down there. Is the problem that it's declining because of the tropical change of habitat changes, or is it here in Wisconsin, the upper Midwest? Between us and Minnesota, we've got more than 50% of the world's population here. So we're critical to that bird. But where's the problem? Why is it declining? We're continuing our surveys up here, and we're trying to coordinate some down there. So that's one example of some of the things that we're trying to reach into. There's also an issues committee. I know Noel works on that, trying to look at some of the more pressing conservation issues. And what can we do as just general information and education for people to highlight the issues and to give them some hints of how they can help? So it is a broad and comprehensive broad conservation initiative, looking at all birds in all habitats, keeping common birds common, and keeping them from becoming endangered, and looking across the states at the important bird areas and a comprehensive conservation strategy. So it's a very complex approach, but we're trying to get an umbrella over all of these different disparate efforts that have been going on, because there's a lot of conservation interest in many different species. How do we bring all these people together in all their common interests and try to work together, pool some resources, and try to help not just a single species, but a number of associates?
That's Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, our guests today, as we talk about ornithology in Wisconsin and abroad. And let's go to Carl in Osseo next. Hi, Carl.
Yes. My question is basically a concern of global warming. I've noticed several changes in birds that are in my area all winter. I feed birds all winter, and for the first time I had a pair of mourning doves that stayed all winter, and I was just wondering if that was unusual or not. And my second question is, I've heard several reports of robins wintering over in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, what are they eating? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Carl. Thanks very much. Noel, do you want to approach that?
Sure. And before I go on to that, I just want to mention that Bill talked about the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. There is a website out there. It's www.wisconsinbirds.org. And it has information about the initiative and all the committees and the various projects that are ongoing. So people can check that out. And as Bill mentioned, the Issues Committee is addressing various topical issues. It's confronting Wisconsin bird conservation, whether it's lead or what it may be. And global climate is certainly an issue that's with us and going to be with us for a long time. And it certainly is, to me, one of the most complex issues that we're going to have to deal with. I just recently heard Chuck Hagner, who works with Birders World magazine out in Waukesha County, talking about, after hearing several different papers at a
North American conference down in Mexico, that it's really clear that our notion of conserving biodiversity, whether it's plant life or various kinds of animals that's existed in the past, is really fast becoming obsolete, because we're going to have to look at take climate change into account in all future conservation planning, because things are changing so rapidly. There are studies coming out almost on a daily basis talking about changes that we're seeing in bird life or butterfly populations or the blooming of plants that are being documented, that's occurring earlier and earlier and earlier. And, of course, when that occurs, a lot of different things can happen. Some species will not be able to adapt or change rapidly enough to these changes and lose out in the process. There's chances of you would have a disconnect with birds arriving earlier when the food sources that they depend on may not be available to them. So there's just a whole wide variety of issues surrounding the changes in our climate that are affecting our birds, going to be affecting them in the future, and how some of these are going to play out are yet to be seen. Mourning doves are one of, getting specifically to the two species he asked about. Mourning doves are continuing to increase in Wisconsin. We're seeing more and more overwintering. We can see this on Christmas bird counts and other data that's taken in the state. They're overwintering farther north in Wisconsin than they used to several decades ago, so they are responding to changes. You mentioned robins overwintering. Some years we see more robins overwintering in the state than other years. Primarily, it kind of depends upon how early the freeze up or what the fall temperatures are. But there's certainly berries for them to feed on. One of the berries that is more available to them now than might have been 20 years ago is the invasive buckthorn. It's a woody plant that produces prolific berries, and these are available to robins in the wintertime. But crabapples and some of the dogwoods and mountain ash, and there's a variety of other native plants also that produce berries in the fall and into the winter that robins can find and live on. So both of those species, I think, are reacting to changes in our climate.
Very good. And to Liz in Ellsworth next. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I was just wondering if a loon was more closely related to a duck or geese, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Bill?
Neither.
Thank you.
It's related to neither. In habits, they're probably, say, closer to ducks as being highly aquatic, where geese tend to be upland grazers. That's at least in their habits. But loons are in their own family, and as such, there are only four species of loons in North America. And the common loon is certainly the one that we see here. Out on the Great Lakes, we will see red-throated loons and occasionally the Pacific loon as they migrate through the area. But as far as related to ducks or geese, they're not really related to either of them, though they share a similar habitat or environment. And one thing curious about loons is that today everybody thinks of it as such a quintessential symbol of the Northwoods. And yet you look back 100-plus years ago, and they nested all across southern Wisconsin and even northern Illinois around the lakes. It's just simply with the development that we've experienced around these lakes so early on that we more or less pushed them into the north woods as their last stronghold. And that's why the concern for keeping them on our northern lakes, where we now have at least a stable population, and we want to keep it that way.
Our guests are Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, and if you'd like to join in, we have a couple lines open for you in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. That's toll-free, of course, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Now, recently, a bald eagle was found barely alive in Ozaukee County from lead poisoning, and a listener wanted to know where that lead was coming from. Noel, I know that this is something that is very crucial to you.
Yes, it is. It's an issue that I think we need to address more aggressively than we have here in recent years in the state. I think Wisconsin's behind a few other states in taking action to try to eliminate lead from our environment, primarily through removing lead shot from hunting and recreational shooting, as well as lead in fishing tackle. Some states and areas are starting to really become much, much more restrictive in the use of lead in both of these recreational pursuits. And it only takes one piece of lead, you know, one lead sinker to cause lead poisoning in a loon we were just talking about, or for an eagle to pick up lead shot when it's consuming on a roadkill deer that might have some lead pellets in it. So it doesn't take a whole lot of lead to kill a wildlife species, and it's well documented that, for example, loons in New England kill almost half of the birds that die from various causes. It's from lead mortality, from lead sinkers and lead jigs. We talked about WBSI and the Bird Conservation Initiative a few minutes ago. There is a white paper out there that the Issues Committee has drafted. I worked with Scott Deal from the Wisconsin Humane Society to draft this, called Lead Poisoning of Wisconsin's Birds. And it is available at the website that I mentioned, www.wisconsinbirds.org/lead-poisoning-paper. And you can download that to find out more facts and research findings. There's a whole lot of different web links, and we also make some recommended actions, which includes going to non-toxic materials for fishing sinkers and jigs. They're now being offered in tin and bismuth and steel and other types of alloys. And the same thing with lead shot. They're now being replaced. There's probably 8 or 9 or 10 different shot types that are approved as non-toxic. And I think we just need, as people interested in wildlife and trying to have them persist in as healthy as environment as we can, we really need to remove lead from our environment.
Bill, your thoughts on that?
I couldn't agree more. Lead exposure is obviously a problem, especially for birds where they're picking up through the food chain, as lead. Noel mentioned here about the lead picked up from, say, eagles off of carcasses,
mm-hmm.
or birds, say, the aquatic birds, especially was a problem for the trumpeter swans. With that long neck, they're easily able to reach into the substrate where some of this stuff may be available, and we've seen a bird of that size become extremely ill from one single pellet. Two or three will kill an adult. So it is highly toxic, and as long as it's widespread out in the environment, it's something that will be an exposure problem, certainly.
Yeah, it's just interesting, too. You know, we've recognized that it's harmful to humans. In fact, there's a new book out I just saw a reference to called The Great Lead Water Pipe Disaster, and they talk about how long we've used lead in our water pipes, and some municipalities are very slow in recognizing this, how much lead from these pipes can get into our systems and cause human problems. We recognize that for humans. We've done something about it. We need to do the same thing for wildlife.
Back to the phones to Shirley in Prentice. Hi, Shirley.
Hello. We have a bluebird nest here. My son was from Minneapolis cleaning it out. 5 babies in there. One was dead, which he removed. He says it was killed by botflies. And my son says, that the nest box should be brushed out frequently. I can't do it, so I wonder if there's a special way. I've heard something about this. The nest sits on a shelf, and below that is a space where you can put wood ashes, and then lice or whatever will drop in the ashes and die. Or is there a way of treating wood in a safe manner, of course, before the box is built, that would repel any of those insects, pests, from coming in? I know they do go right after those babies.
Which of you two gentlemen would like to pursue that?
Well, I do know that the botfly actually crawls up in the evening on the
floor. I'm sorry, it's so faint I can't hear.
All right, well, perhaps you take your answer off the air, and we'll be able to do it that way.
Yeah, the botflies, they move up in the evening to feed on the young and then drop into the lower reaches of the nest, into the nesting material. So as Shirley had mentioned, by putting some sort of screening or mesh with something underneath where they will retreat into and be exposed to. I don't know about ash. A rotenone dusting powder, type of insecticide can work. I wouldn't treat the wood because that's a constant exposure. You just simply want to have something that as those botflies drop into the lower portion of the nest material, that they can pick something up there as a bit of an insect control. And, yeah, they can, you know, young, especially when they're very small, they can draw an awful lot of blood out of them. And with that, it leads to weakness or even death. So it's a short period while they're in the nest, but they can certainly do quite a bit of damage. So it's an individual type of situation.
And on to Steve in Sun Prairie next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, this is Steve. Actually, I'm coming down on Highway 41 from the Upper Peninsula, but we were just a little bit north of Green Bay, around Duck Creek or so, and I swear I saw three whooping cranes flying up at, oh, maybe 1,000 feet or so. Black tips on the wings and very white wing beyond. Is that possible?
Could be pelicans.
Yeah, I would say they're probably white pelicans that are nesting in Green Bay.
Oh, you're right.
We just don't think of white pelicans yet. You know, they've been in the state now for about a decade with a breeding population, and it just doesn't seem like pelicans, a bird like a pelican should be here. But, boy, they definitely are, and the population continues to build. Bill, how many do you have at Horicon this year?
Actually, the high water levels at Horicon has flooded out some of the cattail mats where they were nesting last year. Last year we had 756 pair in Horicon Marsh. This year, 490 pair. So a slight drop, and it's just simply limitations by how much room they have. But still, we had zero nesting there in 1997. So they've really come up. And the big hotspot for them is Horicon Marsh. There are a few nesting in the upper lakes of Winnebago. Green Bay has a tremendous colony, and birds have been spending the summer along the Mississippi for a number of years, and some of these larger river systems are places to watch for them. So as Noel said, it's not a bird you think of for Wisconsin, but they are around.
Well, thank you. I thought for a minute I saw whoopers, but...
always a possibility that we got whooping cranes out there as well. So, do keep your eyes open.
Right.
Steve, thank you so much for your call, and let's move on to Jerry in Green Bay. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi. Last week, I was at Point Beach along Lake Michigan chasing some sanderlings with my camera, and they were pecking at dead fish. And I'm wondering, do they actually feed on them? I thought they were just picking insects off. But now with the pictures, I see their bills are actually plunged well into the fish.
No?
Good question. I'm really not sure. I know they will definitely pick insects and other invertebrates that are attracted to the fish. Whether they would actually eat the flesh of a fish, I guess I'm not sure. Traditionally, you would not think that sanderlings would.
Yeah.
Bill, do you have any thoughts on that?
My only guess is that anything as a protein source is going to work, and I would imagine that their bill is built for probing, so picking right off the surface in the surf and off of the surface of the mud, this is how they're going to feed. But if you've got a fish that's somewhat decomposed, because they normally wouldn't be able to get through that heavy scale, if it's somewhat decomposed, perhaps they are taking a little bit of the flesh out there just as a rare opportunity. It is a protein source, and they've got a long migration. Now, they're going to be nesting above the Arctic Circle, so they're just stopping here for a bit. They've got another 1,000-plus miles to go. Mm. Anything for fuel.
Yeah. Incidentally, I also saw a pair of black-bellied plovers that same day.
Yes, it's a lot of it's pretty dry this spring, and we don't have a lot of flooded fields or areas where shorebirds are stopping inland. So the Lake Michigan lakeshore has been quite productive in the last couple of weeks. There's been good sightings all the way up from, you know, Sheboygan, Manitowoc, Kewaunee, of a number of shorebirds, and the black-bellied plovers, like the sanderlings, are heading far north of the state, and they love beaches and to forage along for insects. In fact, we saw a couple at Horicon Marsh on the north side of Highway 49 last night foraging along with some sandpipers.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Jerry, thank you very much for the call. We're talking about birds, resident migrant birds of Wisconsin, with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County and Bill Volkert at the Horicon Marsh. And we will continue to take your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on Memorial Day for this program of Ornithology of Wisconsin with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. I'm Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller. I know that we're going to begin the breeding bird surveys in Wisconsin in a few days. And Noel, tell us about what goes on first in the southern part of the state.
Well, throughout Wisconsin, we now have 92 roadside routes that are
Volunteers are recruited to sample these roadside routes once a year in the month of June. It takes between 4 and 5 hours. And fortunately here in Wisconsin, we've always had plenty of volunteers to draw from, and typically all these routes are assigned to these folks each year. And you have to be out there at the starting point a half an hour before sunrise. So we're talking about 4:30, 4:40 in the morning. It takes 4 to 5 hours to complete the 50 stops along this route. And the same routes, the same stops are done every year, and they have been doing these now for about 40 years. And it's a way to really monitor many of our bird populations that could be sampled in this way. It doesn't do a real good job on some of the wetland species or some of the more nocturnal species. But for the great majority of the birds that breed in Wisconsin, the Breeding Bird Survey is the primary way that we can track trends. We talked about increasing, decreasing birds. A lot of the knowledge we have for these trends comes from the BBS data.
And Bill, will you also be involved in the Breeding Bird Surveys?
I haven't conducted them for a number of years just because it's my peak season and a lot of demand for at work. But I certainly keep track of that and a number of other surveys. And when we talk about population declines of birds, you will hear something to the effect of a particular species declining at, say, 1.5% per year or something like that. Because of the way these surveys are done, we have no real way of knowing the raw numbers of birds that are out there, what we started with or what we have. It's a matter of what we call frequency of occurrence. So as you run your route, you're just doing a transect, a line through some nice mixed habitat, and you're looking at how often those birds show up along just those routes. And what we're looking for is the rate of change. And with 90-some routes in Wisconsin and hundreds of these all across the United States, we get some idea on both regional and continental scale of which ones are increasing, decreasing, or staying the same. And the only thing we know is the rate of change. We don't know the numbers that we started with or how many we have. We just know that we're picking them up at either an increasing or decreasing rate along these routes. And as Noel said, there's a number of biases. A lot of this is done by ear, so we have seen some routes where rare species show up and disappear with different observers. Just because the rarer the bird is, the harder it is to know those songs. And some birds are more vocal. They call more often. They call later into the morning as you continue those routes. They also, their voices carry farther than others, so they're easier to detect. So there are a number of biases within it, but as Noel said, it is by far the most comprehensive continental survey we have, and really one of the main things that we use to keep the pulse of birds. And then as we add into it, the winter Christmas bird counts, the winter surveys, a number of other different counts and surveys that are done out there. And now with the citizen monitoring that we're doing with the Cornell Project, people are sending in their daily bird checklists. There's just hundreds of different ways for us to try to keep some sort of tabs of how are the birds doing and how are they doing in different parts of the state, different parts of the country, and as populations as a whole.
And, Noel, can they get more information at wisconsinbirds.org or some other site?
It's there is a Breeding Bird Survey site that it has a lot of the data and so forth. The best place I can give you, should I give you an email address out over the air?
Sure,
or not?
Sure.
The coordinator here in Wisconsin is Mark Korducki, and he is responsible for rounding people up. And his address is Korducki, K-O-R-D-U-C-K-I, at earthlink.net. I think all the routes are taken for this year. I know that I've been doing five now for almost 30 years in Wisconsin, a couple down in Racine, Kenosha, a couple up in Marinette County, and one over in Menominee County, Michigan. We're picking up, my son and I, in fact, my son is doing his first one this year. He's picking up one from a friend who can't do it. He's going to be unavailable in June. In fact, it starts over west of Horicon, Bill, and then heads up toward Rosendale. So he's going to be doing his first one this year, but Mark Korducki is the one to correspond with. If you have an interest in running this or more information about the BBS, Korducki at earthlink.net.
All right. If anyone wants to look at the data from the breeding bird surveys, that's being stored and coordinated by the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center out near Washington, D.C., and I think they could just simply search under breeding bird survey. And from there, they could be able to look at the different species, the trends, and so forth.
Very good. To Sally in Fox Valley. Hi, Sally. What can we do for you?
Good morning. A five note bird sound I have not heard since the 1960s in Portage County in the summertime. I'm wondering what kind of bird made it. Four ascending notes, one descending note.
Ah. You said four ascending and then one descending?
Exactly.
Where were you hearing this? What kind of habitat? Forest, wetland?
What was the habitat that you were...
Backyard?
Farm.
A farm, okay.
Boy.
You may have them stumped.
You have them stumped, that's right. Yeah. Bird song, what one person hears and describes is so difficult to put into someone else's mind and have them go through their flashcards of bird songs and come up with a possibility.
Sally, describe that again to the best of your ability.
Four ascending notes.
But you actually did the call. You did the call, so.
Do, 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 do. Over and over and over. With a period of silence in between.
Well, we'll let you gentlemen ruminate about that over the next part of the program and see if something shakes loose.
It'll probably ring a bell with one of our listeners out there, too.
All right. Sally, we'll try to get an answer for you. You've come up with the first stumper of the day, and so we'll put our collective minds together and see if we can't come up with an answer on that in the next 35 minutes of the program. Our telephone number in Madison is 263-1890 and otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. And if you think you know what that bird is, why, give us a call. We'll be happy to hear from you. Let's go to Jackie next in Plymouth. Jackie.
Good morning. I'm wondering, a while back in the program, in the beginning, you mentioned that there were flyers or something like that. I just caught the tail end of it for people to know where to go look for birds and things like that. Does that sound familiar with what you were talking about?
Oh, the Wisconsin Bird and Nature Trail. Department of Tourism has been helping to distribute that, and you should be able to pick that up at a number of the state parks and tourism outlets. And it is a series of brochures. We're developing these regionally around the state. I think
I can barely hear you. It's a whisper.
They're working on those.
Well, there are two of you on the same telephone line. That's why you're not able to hear that. Uh-oh. So it might be easier for you if you listened off the air.
Okay. Well, second question that I did have, too, is I know that a theologian named Hartshorne, who was also a ornithologist, though not, not teaching in school, but a well-respected ornithologist, once wrote a book about why birds sing. And he said basically his conclusion was, and he was a well-known amateur ornithologist, ended up saying that he felt birds sang for the joy of singing, as well as, you know, for mating and things like that. But birds often sing for other reasons. Any comments about that that other people might have said? And I'll hang up and ask for that information again.
Okay.
If there's a website, that would be cool, too.
There is a website. Let me address that first. It is at the same website that I talked about for WBSI. It's www.wisconsinbirds.org, then it's /trail/maps, and there's five different sets of maps for Wisconsin, the ones for Lake Superior, the Northwoods area, Mississippi, Chippewa Rivers, and this past year Lake Michigan are available. That we've been doing one set each year, so the 2007 set was for the 11 Lake Michigan counties, and those are all available from the Department of Tourism or many of the DNR offices, but you can also download them from the website that I just gave. The Central Sands Prairie area and the Southern Savannah area will be completed in 2008 and 2009. But all these maps and information can be downloaded from www.wisconsinbirds.org/trail/maps. The other question about the ornithologist, I'm familiar with his work, and he has some interesting perspectives. As you pointed out, there are certainly some definite reasons why birds do sing, to recognize where they are, to establish their territories, to attract potential mates, and to try to keep the other males out of the territories. But, at times, why do the birds appear to play at times? It's very easy to put anthropomorphism type of traits into bird actions and behavior. But I guess it wouldn't surprise me that birds sing just because they enjoy singing.
Bill, your thought?
I think there's always that possibility, as Noel says. You know, we do know that ravens, for example, actually play. There are, we've seen, or at least documented, of them sliding down snowbanks in Alaska, the tumbling in the air. That doesn't have a outright purpose or function for survivorship. And, you know, birds certainly, as Noel said, have this real biological function in singing, but once they've established a territory, and even into the nesting season, they continue to sing. Biologists oftentimes explain that as a reinforcement of the pair bond. They keep each other in contact and committed to raise those young. Is there something beyond that? Is it just simply somehow celebrating a nice new morning for them just because they can sing, that they continue on beyond just purpose? Who knows? And I think this is one of the fascinating things of watching birds and other wildlife is that we've got a really good understanding of wildlife today like never before, especially in our ecology and behavior, but there are those mysteries, and we're always shut out a little bit from trying to, on one hand, read something in and understand in that bird's mind, what are they doing out there that oftentimes may defy explanation, and yet that sense of caution, as Noel said, you can't just attribute human traits to it, and there is a little bit of that mystery. And with that, I guess also room for individual interpretation. There's something just wonderful about nature that still defies just a solid scientific explanation.
Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright are guests, and we will continue right after the news on the Ideas Network. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on Memorial Day. Very happy to have you with us today as we continue a tradition of talking about ornithology, resident migrant birds of Wisconsin. Noel Cutright is the current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, a former president of that body, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, which was years in the making. Bill Volkert, a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horican Marsh, and he told us about construction beginning later this year on a nearly $5 million education center to be located at the Horican Marsh following approval by the State Building Commission. That'll be something that we'll be following in the months ahead. And we will take your phone calls about your bird sightings, questions about their behaviors, and more. That'll be coming up after the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Memorial Day. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about bird life in Wisconsin and elsewhere with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, the former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. He is the senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horican Marsh. And we've been talking for the last hour about birds. And we will continue to take your calls and talk about birds. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And again, Noel, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Jim. And I've been trying to rack my brain about the bird song and I'm kind of coming up with maybe a warbler, either northern parula or parula warbula, P-A-R-U-L-A. Maybe even a yellow warbler. There's several, or at least there's a few species of warbler that tend to have upward songs and then a downward note at the end. And I also looked up sanderling food habits. We had a question a while ago about observation of a sanderling, which is a shorebird that's heading for the Arctic Circle, seen along the beach at Point Beach, picking at dead fish, and I can't find anywhere in the literature, from what I can see, that where they feed upon fish. So I think they might have been after some other critters that were in the fish's body.
And Bill, thank you for spending time with us today. What are your thoughts about that mystery bird?
Oh, I've been running it through my mind, too. And, you know, we've talked about this before, that we can describe the pattern of the call. So the number of notes and a little bit of variation. But oftentimes people rely also on the tonal quality of the voice, and that's something that we just can't imitate. It's been rolling around in my mind. I think Noel's guesses are as good as any.
Let us see if there's somebody out there who knows. That could be Laura in Avoca. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Well, I'm sorry that's not what I'm calling about.
Okay.
And in the time that I've been...
You're calling, though, about a Baltimore Oriole, correct?
Right.
And somebody thought that it was a Baltimore Oriole, Barbara in Richland County. And,
well?
if that's the case.
Yeah, interesting, because the Baltimore Oriole my experience is that it's one of the most beautiful singers with a variety of songs.
So that's probably not the answer to her question.
I don't think so, but, you know, since I did call, I'm laughing at myself, sorry, because the dog. I sort of answered my own original question, which was, when my glasses are off, I keep seeing these birds that, and I was going to say, if I didn't know better, I would have thought that they were female Baltimore Orioles. And I don't know where I got the idea that Baltimore Orioles did not differ between the genders. And I'm thinking, in fact, that's what I'm seeing, an absolute riot of female and juveniles because of a similar but a little bit softer coloration. So I'm switching questions to this. Are the Baltimore Orioles, do they stick around for the entire warm season, or are they just passing through?
Good question.
Depends on where you are. With certain Orioles, you just don't, for whatever reason, don't stick around a property or in someone's yard where they're very noticeable when they arrive here in May, typically. But they do breed throughout Wisconsin. Probably in every county in the state, you will have Baltimore Orioles from the time they arrive here in early May, right into the fall season. They'll be around on a daily basis.
And
I
Bill,
can ask one more quick question, because I spend most of my time living closer to Chicago. I live across the street from a pretty well-known animal conservation woods. It's interesting to me to see the difference between the birds. And I'm seeing lots and lots of warblers up here, and I guess I have the same kind of question regarding the warblers. Am I just seeing them migrating through now, or am I far enough north? I don't know if you know where Avoca is. Say, like Spring Green or Dodgeville. I'm kind of near those places.
Yeah.
Where the warblers are going to be hanging out for a while.
Bill?
Well, warblers make a group of more than 30 species in Wisconsin, and we have a number of them that are nesting across the state, as well as the migrants. As we get toward the end of May, we're getting toward the end of the migration for the songbirds. As Noel mentioned, the shorebirds, the sandpipers and plovers, some of those will stick around for a bit as they're refueling on their way to the Arctic. But this is why, as we talked earlier about the breeding bird surveys, they normally begin in Wisconsin in early June, because at that time, even with the late spring, all the birds that should have migrated through are gone, and everything that you hear and see are the summer nesting birds. So this big group of 30-some species of warblers, some are quite common, the yellow warblers found throughout the area. Yellow throats can be found quite readily, the red start. As you get into northern Wisconsin, other warblers are up in the Northwoods for nesting, and others will continue north of Lake Superior, some of them right to the edge of the tree line in the subarctic shrub habitat. So they distribute themselves across a wide range of habitats. But migration is a time to look for them all, which was a few weeks ago as a real peak. And we may have a few stragglers yet, but we're getting to the end of their movement.
And let's go to Eben next in Evansville. Eben, go ahead.
Yes, yesterday I saw a red-headed woodpecker, and right in the same woods, just really close to there, very shortly afterwards, I saw what appeared to me to be a white-headed male woodpecker. Is it possible that they could be here, or that one came through for some reason? It did not look like a downy or a hairy woodpecker. It didn't have the speckles. It was a solid black with a white on the wings, and then just the red along the back of the head.
That sounds more like red-bellied woodpecker. The white-headed is the western bird.
I realize that, but the head was totally white, except for on the very back of the head. I mean,
well,
that's what it...
Something like partial albinism.
Albinism is what I would say, because white-headed woodpeckers, I'm not sure we ever had a sighting of a white-headed in Wisconsin.
Move that far either, so for them to come this far, we get some stragglers of other birds, but no, I doubt if they would ever be traveling this far to the east. I think maybe you've got something as an anomaly showing a partial albinism, and that can always throw you. Yep, birds, you know, there's enough color patterns to try to remember, and when you get something that doesn't have the true pattern, that's always a good trick out there that can stump you.
So that's fairly common with a red-headed to have basically a white head? That's pretty cool. I mean,
I'm thinking of the red, yeah, that red-headed or the red-bellied woodpecker would be another
okay.
possibility.
But no, it would not be common. It'd be uncommon to see that.
So albinism seems to be the factor at work here. Evan, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Tom in Fitchburg. Tom, you're on the air.
Good. Hello.
Yes.
Two quick questions. One, you said something about crows not bothering other birds. And a friend of mine, I thought they could be predatory sometime, and a friend of mine said she was watching one the other day go after some small birds.
What species were you inquiring about?
Crows.
Oh.
Well, crows will definitely prey upon other species.
Well, I thought you said that they wouldn't.
Well, they're not a blackbird. We were talking about blackbirds, and I mentioned sometimes that crows, because they are black, are thought to be a part of the blackbird group, but they are not related, just as starlings are not related to blackbirds. So when we're talking about blackbirds, crows should not be included in that group, but crows will take small birds or predate on other species. Crows will take a young rabbit, for example. We don't often think of crows as being that predacious, but they can be. They're very omnivorous, and as Bill mentioned, they're opportunistic. And if they can take a young bird or a young mammal of some kind or a young snake or a snake of some kind, they will prey upon them. But they're not a blackbird. They are a black bird, but they're not a blackbird.
Okay, Tom?
Yeah, the second quick question. A small, light, softly gray bird has been on my back slab, eating seeds and dropping from the trees here. I thought it was a mourning dove. And so did a friend of mine who was here once. But a good friend of mine who watches birds a lot said, do you know what these small little gray birds are? And she did not think it was. Could it have been anything but a mourning dove?
Well, the other dove that has shown up in Wisconsin somewhat recently has been the ringed turtle dove. That's our collared turtle dove. You know, that's another bird that's a possibility out there. And we've got some of these that are escapees out of the pet trade as well. So there's always that possibility. You know, I've had a number of calls where people have had, even parrots in backyards and parakeets. So there's oftentimes even, you know, something that's out of the pet trade that could be out there, as well as some of these other dove members here that are starting to show up in Wisconsin.
Tom, thanks very much for the call. Sorry we couldn't get a definitive answer for you. Let's go to Tim in River Falls next. Tim.
Yeah, good afternoon. My wife and I are novice bird watchers, and we have the opportunity to migrate to the Gulf Coast of Texas every winter, and we're just within a few miles of the Whooping Crane area down there, the reserve that has those.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they had an attempt to relocate some in Florida, like 18, I think it was, that were wiped out by a tornado. And this area that they seem to habitate in Texas is only somewhere in the range of 5 to 10 miles of Gulf Coast, and I would think would be very susceptible to one hurricane hit. Is there an additional effort to relocate whooping cranes elsewhere?
Well, that's exactly why we're doing the reintroduction in Wisconsin, the release of birds there, because we want a second flock. There's been a whole history. They tried what was called cross-fostering out in Idaho to raise whooping cranes under the sandhill cranes. It worked well with trumpeter swans. It does not work with cranes because as they grew up, there was a big learning curve. They thought they were sandhill cranes and began to mate with other sandhills, and there was a lack of species recognition. The Florida release was a non-migratory flock that was in the Kissimmee River region. And the thought was there, they would be much safer if we could just put them in one area and leave them there year-round. And history does tell us that there was a relic small population of whooping cranes along the Gulf Coast, mostly Mississippi, Louisiana, that never did migrate. The problem is that they're very susceptible to bobcat predation. So that population has not done very well. The Wisconsin flock has been building on all that experience to get a second migratory flock that is entirely distinct in terms of its movement and pattern from that Aransas wood buffalo population. As you said, we've literally got all of our eggs in one basket. And if something happened as some sort of environmental catastrophe, oil spill in wintertime along the coast, a hurricane that may come in late in the season while the birds are there, something to this effect, disease outbreak, it could just literally imperil the entire world population. So now we're starting with the Wisconsin slow release, migrating the birds down behind the ultralight airplane, and eventually having a independent second population. This is very important for conservation. You can't have all your birds in just one single area because they are vulnerable to some of these catastrophic events.
All right. Jim in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. My question has to do with top speeds of birds. And the common belief, and it might be right, is the peregrine falcon is the fastest in a dive. But are the swifts faster in straight-line flight like a chimney swift?
Chimney swifts, I think we've got kind of a modest speed, but I think some of the ducks are probably for all out. Would probably rival peregrine or some of those. No?
I would agree. I think the waterfowl typically, just in a straight line flight, are among the fastest. And as you mentioned, the falcons, especially the peregrine, are in a stoop, are the fastest. But the swift is not all that swift when it comes to flight. They have short wings. They're really adapted for maneuvering more than they are for speed.
Mm-hmm. I was talking with a wildlife photographer, and he posed the question about the fastest bird in straight line flight, and he said that a chimney swift or a vox swift was clocked at 125. But,
perhaps in a good stoop itself, but also keep in mind that the size of the bird sometimes gives you an appearance that they're moving fast. I know I've had duck hunters tell me the fastest duck out there has got to be the teal. Well, they're also just so small, they're harder to hit than anything. They're mm-hmm. not going any faster. So that may give a little bit of the illusion of speed.
Well, yeah, a swift will set their wings just like a peregrine will when they're diving into a chimney, and they definitely are very rapid. But at that time, they're also not flapping or moving their wings. They just have them set, and they're diving.
So you think some of the duck species are very, very quick?
Mergansers, they'll hit straight-out speeds of 65, 70 miles an hour. Red-breasted merganser has been clocked to that. Old squaw, what's now called long-tailed duck, another one of the high-speed flyers. Those birds will really move out across open water.
But that's not anywhere near the top speed of a peregrine at 100.
Up to 200.
Over
miles
two?
Yeah,
well,
over.
That's in a dive, but in a straight-line flight, they've been clocked at 100, I believe.
I talked about this with a friend of mine, Chris Cole, who's a wildlife technician up in Park Falls area, and he's got a few birds he uses for falconry, and we've discussed what is actually the best quantifiable information on peregrine speeds, and there are a number of references that I've read about, 185, 210, he said somewhere 250 was thrown out there, but, you know, I think it may be hard to really clock these things well when you're in a free fall that high up, so maybe the technology is a little limited to give us a good really good handle. I did see one somewhere on a special where they had a little spring-loaded gauge that they had on a falconry bird, and that one was hitting 200 miles an hour. But there again, what is the fastest these things have ever gone? Hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jim, thanks very much. Very fast indeed, though. Therese is next in Green Bay. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a question about the eagles that are nesting at the Brown County Fairgrounds in the Green Bay Pier area. That's in a urban area, and I've been watching them, and the mother's been sitting on the nest, of course, and last night there were fireworks as part of a festival in De Pere, and I went this morning fearing that the birds, you know, would be scared off by that, and I believe they launched them from that side of the river. So I did not see the mother on the nest this morning, so what are the chances that that kind of noise would have scared the birds off? And I will take my answer off the air and hope that later when I go back tonight I'll find them there, but I'm skeptical.
Okay, Therese.
Thank you.
Well, I hope that the birds will also be there. You know, loud sounds, and that, the birds get very accustomed to the sounds around where they are, and they become very used to that. But anything that's really quite different, depending on the closeness and so forth, and also depends on the individual bird, can be disturbing, and they will abandon. I remember a few years ago when we didn't know we had peregrine falcons nesting on the high-rise bridge in downtown, or the Hone Bridge near the harbor in downtown Milwaukee, when they had the Blue Angel aircraft come through, the young hopped off the bridge and landed on the ground below. So something that striking can definitely impact the birds. We were concerned a little bit a few years ago in Port Washington when we had peregrine falcons nesting on the power plant there, and they shoot off fireworks from the coal dock very close to the plant, but they didn't seem to be bothered by that at all. So I think it's probably varies somewhat by species. It varies by the explosiveness of the sound and how unusual that sound is, and also probably varies by the particular individual. Some become more startled than others. Eagles are pretty tenacious to their web or to their nest site when they have eggs, or especially when they get young. So I guess I'm just guessing that you'll probably find the eagle back on that nest next time you check.
Well, no, I think you hit on something interesting, that you've got two kinds of disturbance during nesting. One is of the adults abandoning it. Eagles nest relatively early, so as they invest more and more time and energy into those young, they'll put up with that disturbance more likely late in nesting than they did early on. But there's also a chance for the young, as they get bigger, to get spooked. And as you said, with the peregrines jumping the nest prematurely, that's another stage of nesting that they could be vulnerable to.
Well, we've got the breeding bird surveys starting up in a few days. And when will the results of that survey be available to people?
They routinely have those online. It's pretty much electronic submittals now, even though some people do still report them on paper. Those will be incorporated into the database later this year or early next year. I know you can go in now and check out a particular route and see the data from 2006. So they get them up there pretty quick. But, of course, all this data is rolled in to determine or help determine what the trend populations are for this information.
And, Bill, I know that earlier this month, 2 weeks ago, you had your 10th annual Horick and Marsh Bird Festival. And do you plan to do the same next year?
Absolutely. We do it during the Mother's Day weekend. So it's a great time to come out to Horick and Marsh. It is at the peak of the migration, a great time to see a good variety of birds. And also with Horick and Marsh being so rich in bird life, it's a great opportunity to be able to share with people a large variety of Wisconsin's rich bird life. And one fascinating weekend. But there's things you can do on your own all throughout the year. Get a pair of binoculars, a book, and head out in the woods.
And last year, a glossy ibis showed up for the festival, and this year we have 8 glossy ibis at Horicon this past week.
Among 157 species of birds sighted during the weekend, so it must have been a pretty spectacular time. And if people want more information, I know we've given a couple of the websites, wisconsinbirds.org, and what will people find there, Noel?
They'll find the information on different bird conservation activities by the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, information on the important bird areas of Wisconsin, and we're working on a book that will be talking about what these areas are. They'll be coming out later this year, and maybe we can have a program specifically on IBAs and what the various committees are doing, issue papers, a wealth of information on the WisconsinBird.org site, as well as Wisconsin Society for Ornithology's website.
And if you had to pick one spot that you would go to this afternoon for a wealth of bird sightings, what would that spot be?
Oh, boy. I'm going to journey along with a few other friends along the Lake Michigan shoreline looking for some of these shorebirds like sanderlings. We have a kind of an explosion of laughing gulls in the state, so I'd probably head for places from Kewaunee to Coleraandre State Park to Harrington Beach State Park and kind of spend the afternoon along the lakeshore.
And, Bill, one spot for you?
Oh, I suppose I'd be back at Horicon.
Right,
March.
At Horicon.
It's an obvious one.
He's never going
spend,
to.
The rest of the day in my own backyard. I live on the edge of the Northern Kettle Moraine, and I'm just enjoying the birds here. I've got red-shouldered hawks that have been screaming overhead and are nesting not far from here.
It sounds great. Bill, we have to let it go right okay. there. We have run out of time. Thanks so much to each of you for spending time with us today. It's been a lot of fun, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Noel Cutright, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas and former president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Bill Volkert can be found most days at the Horican Marsh. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production. Tomorrow, we will be talking more on the Ideas Network.